Reinhardt Glass, and this is It's All About Food. Good afternoon. It's April 25th, 2012. And have we all recovered over Earth Day this past weekend? It was a great weekend for me. It was my birthday, and I really appreciate all the lovely messages I got from people. And if you sent me one, thank you very much. It was really very fun. The thing is, though, that even though we celebrate Earth Day once a year, it really needs to be every day. This is our home, planet Earth, and we really need to pay attention to everything that's going on and take care of it, because this is it, you know. Until we figure out how to populate other planets, we need to take care of this home. And we talk about that quite a bit on this show, the environment and treatment of animals and the health of everyone that's degrading, mostly because we're not really taking care of ourselves, are we? But today, especially for the first part of the show, I want to concentrate on the fun part of food and how it's really easy, it's delicious, it's fresh, and once you come over to the healthy food side, all the benefits start streaming in. You get all this energy, you start looking hot, and at the same time, you're walking gently on the planet. And it's easy. It's just a win-win all around. So that's why I love talking about food, especially delicious, healthy food, and that's what we're going to be doing right now. I'm going to bring on my first guest, Amber Shea Crawley, and she's got a lovely new book out. I don't really want to call it a cookbook per se because it's mostly raw recipes. She's a linguist, chef, and author specializing in healthful vegan and raw food. Known for her flexible recipes and friendly voice, she was classically trained in the art of gourmet living cuisine at the world-renowned Matthew Kennedy Academy, graduating in 2010 as a certified raw and vegan chef. In 2011, she earned her nutrition educator certification at the Living Light Culinary Arts Institute. And you can find her at her blog at almostveganchef.com. Welcome to It's All About Food, Amber.
Hi, how are you?
Great, how are you?
I'm doing well. Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, and
okay.
I hope everyone else can. Okay, well, thanks for writing this book, and I enjoyed reading it, and I'm going to enjoy getting to know it better as I make more of the recipes.
That's great.
Let's just learn a little bit about you. It's always interesting, I find. I'm going to back up a little. You know, raw food has had its trendy moments in the last decade with celebrities getting all excited about it and promoting it. And it's really just food like we're supposed to be eating it before we got totally bent out of shape with all this high-tech processing of food. It's crazy.
It's true. I think a lot of people think that raw food is overly complicated and takes a lot of time to prepare, but if you do it right, I mean, a lot of things lead to less preparation than cooked food. It's really easy just to make a smoothie or a salad or juice or blend together some nuts and dried fruit for dessert. I mean, a lot of it is surprisingly instant.
Yeah. So what was your journey? How did you get to getting interested in preparing raw food?
Well, I've been vegan for a few years, since early 2008.
Okay, now you're coming in and out.
Oh.
Uh-oh.
Can you hear me okay?
No.
Uh-oh.
Oh, now you're better.
Better now?
Yes.
Okay. Let me know if that happens again.
I will. Okay.
Okay. So I was saying I've been vegan since 2008, and I originally got into veganism for health reasons. And so it just kind of was a natural progression for me to, you know, eat fewer and fewer of the processed fake meat products and things like that, and just keep bringing in more fresh foods. And I think things really turned around for me when I first had a chance to eat at Matthew Kenny's restaurant in Oklahoma City, and I just grew in love, head over heels in love with raw food, and I knew that that was so good, and I wanted to take everything from then on out.
Yeah, I remember going to Pure Food and Wine here in New York City when it first opened, it was really exciting. That was his restaurant at the time. It isn't anymore, but really beautiful place. And one of the things I found about Raw Kitchens, I remember getting a tour of one in California. It's not open anymore, but at the time, this was in the 90s. Compared to, if anybody's ever had a chance to go into a restaurant kitchen, even though there's a lot of regulations to keep them clean, you see all different kinds of stains all over the place and oil-coated things, and not in a Raw Kitchen. Raw Kitchens are clean.
Yeah, I agree. I saw that at the Matthew Kenny OKC restaurant. I've never seen a kitchen like that before. I mean, it was completely open to the dining room, and people, I mean, it wasn't hot and steamy, and people weren't just rushing around and clanging pans and things like that. It was really calm and really just enjoyable to be around, which regular kitchens aren't always that way.
Yeah, I think if more people saw what was going on behind the scenes, they might even be more interested in eating this way.
Yeah, very possibly. Everything is very clean, and it's easy to see how that can get translated into really clean, fresh food.
And when it's clean in the kitchen, it's going to be clean when you eat it.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, okay. So I'm just curious, what is it like training at these different places? You trained with Matthew Kennedy, and then you went on to the Living Light Institute.
Mm-hmm.
How I guess you haven't had training in other culinary institutes, but I'm just kind of curious what it's like to go to through a curriculum like that.
It was like being on a playground all day, every day at the Matthew Kinney Academy. It's just, that was heaven for me to be around, you know, just buckets of fresh raw ingredients and produce and just everything was, it's what I liked to do in my spare time. You know, I just like to mess around in the kitchen and play around and create things and try recipes. And I got to do that for several hours a day for several weeks at a time. So it was not at all, I felt no pressure. I mean, there's not like big exams or anything like that. It's just every day going in the kitchen and creating new things and experimenting and kind of learning to find your own voice with food and, you know, learn how to deliver your own flavors and how to make it your own.
You know, we see so much crazy stuff on television. I have to put a disclaimer here because I don't watch very much television, but I am aware that there are a lot of reality shows and a lot of them are involved with food, and you see so much stress in the kitchen and the competition and things getting done on time, and I really don't like the idea of combining food with stress.
Oh, exactly. I think food, a lot of times for me, it's therapeutic to go and take my time chopping the ingredients and putting something together. And yeah, the high-octane, high-stress environment of things like that just never appealed to me at all.
Yeah, and surely if you're working in a restaurant, there's going to be a certain amount of focus. But I think food preparation, especially at home, it can be zen-like if you know what you're doing and get in that mode, and that's the way it should be.
I agree.
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. Let's jump into this lovely little book here. Okay. One of the things I wanted to talk about is you have a whole section on hummus. And
yes, I do.
Excuse me?
I said, yes, I do.
Yeah. And hummus, it's interesting how popular hummus has become in this country. I'm not sure when it really got a turn in momentum. In, I mean, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, I'm not quite sure, but there was a time when no one was eating hummus, and now it's everywhere.
Yeah, I don't think there's a bar in my town that doesn't even have hummus on the bar menu, so it's everywhere.
Yeah, and it's usually a very safe thing for people like vegetarians when they're going to some mainstream event. Very often you can find hummus and then you go, oh, there's something for me to eat.
Yeah, that's true.
And now there are so many different ways to make hummus. So I want to, it's funny because I'm thinking if First thing I want to say so many things at the same time. It's always very difficult for me. My tongue starts getting all twisted. hummus, I don't know if you know this, but the origin of hummus or what it means is from Arabic and from Hebrew. Hummus means chickpeas.
Right, yeah.
And we've gone quite a long way with what we do with hummus. I mean, some of them that we call hummus don't even contain chickpeas anymore.
Yeah, that's true. I guess nowadays it can just be any puree.
Any kind of schmear or vegetable pate or whatever you want to call it, which is pretty amazing. I remember I've been to Israel a number of times, and I think it was back in the 80s, the first time I was there, I went to a restaurant and I was really hungry, and hummus wasn't really that popular in the United States at the time, but it was on the menu, and I remember not being sure how it was going to be offered. I now know how it's traditionally offered. It's just spread on a plate with, you know, maybe you get some pita bread. But I asked the server, you know, how is it served? I wanted to know if it came with any salad or anything, and she said, hummus? Hummus is hummus. And it's just been like an ongoing kind of thing with me ever since. And hummus is really just hummus, but it isn't anymore. Hummus is many, many different things today.
That's true.
And so you have a lot of different hummus recipes, and you start with three basic ones.
Mm-hmm.
One is
Go ahead.
Yeah, you have the traditional hummus. And okay, one of the things that's great about this book is that it's flexible raw recipes. Mm-hmm. So you're going to find some things that were cooked in here.
That's true.
That's true. We'll get back to hummus, but why did you do that?
Well, I know that a lot of times when I hear people explain why they don't eat raw food or why they haven't gotten into it, they name things like, well, I don't have a dehydrator, I don't have a high-speed blender, I don't know where to get all those fancy superfood ingredients, or I can't afford them, and things like that. And I wanted to show people that adding more raw foods and fresh foods to your life doesn't have to be, you know, an all-or-nothing experience. I mean, I give people directions to warm something up on a stove or to heat it up in the oven, because the point at the end of the day is that you're getting more raw, unprocessed, fresh ingredients into your diet. And if you heat those up a little bit and kill some enzymes, that's okay. It's still great food.
Right. The thing is, we've somehow lost this knowledge of how to prepare food.
Yeah.
And any way that can get people back into the kitchen making food is a good thing.
I agree.
I'm going to get back to the hummus in a minute, but I want to talk about some other things. So I've been a vegan for a long time, and I've always been on this major health path. And I think it was the Living Light Institute. I was invited to speak in Costa Rica in 2004 at a conference they were having. It was a glorious thing because I camped outside. People could stay in little bungalows if they wanted to, or you could camp. And it was a week-long event, and Sherry Soria was there and a number of other people preparing all of this wonderful food. And I had not eaten raw food before, and I decided after that conference that I would eat all raw food. And I did that for 2 years. And and it was just it was a great learning experience, because once, you know, you eliminate certain things, you need to ramp up on other things. And it's true of any time you eliminate certain things from your diet.
Yeah, it challenges your creativity, I think.
And it's great to shift your focus and challenge yourself. But I always found it humorous where people were saying, oh, I'm 65% raw, I'm 85% raw, I'm, you know, 72% raw. And thinking, how do you figure those things out, you know?
Yeah, there's calculations for that I know of, but that's it.
It was really kind of nutty, pun intended. So I really appreciate in your book that you're really just introducing people to lots of luscious, creative ways to use primarily raw food, and not to really get all wrapped up with if you're using a few cooked ingredients. It's just good.
Yeah, or even if you can, you have access to all kinds of ingredients, or maybe you even have a dehydrator or something like that, and you can prepare fully raw food. Maybe you don't have a family that wants raw food. Maybe they want something warm, or maybe they want some pasta or some beans added to it, and I don't see any reason why you can't combine a raw dish with a non-raw ingredient.
Right. Okay, so back to the hummus. So you have these three great recipes. One's the classic chickpea hummus, and the secret ingredient, if anyone doesn't know, is tahini. Anything with tahini is incredible.
Yeah, tahini on its own is great.
Yeah. So you have the classic one with the chickpeas, and then you have this nice zucchini hummus, which instead of the chickpeas, you use raw zucchini.
Yeah, that was, I don't remember the first time I had it prepared that way or the first time I tried that, but I was skeptical because I don't love raw zucchini on its own, and but I knew that it's a very mild flavored vegetable, and it works really well as a palate for something like hummus. And when you puree it with a stronger, more assertive ingredient like tahini, you kind of the zucchini kind of lets the tahini do the talking.
Well, you know, a few people that garden, I always hear when zucchini's in season, they don't know what to do with it. There's just too much of it, and this would be a great thing, a great recipe.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hear that, too.
And then there's the richer version, which is a hummus that instead of using the chickpeas, you're using cashews and macadamia nuts. Now, that just sounds too gooey, too amazing.
It's very rich. That's actually the first way I had raw hummus at Matthew Kearney's restaurant, and it was, I expected it to be incredibly heavy and, it's kind of too much, but it worked really nicely.
You know, I appreciate that you're not using a sprouted chickpea in your hummus, any of your recipes.
Yeah, I'm not a fan of that, personally.
It's, you know, I've had it, and unless you drown it in tons of olive oil and some kind of salt, it doesn't taste very good.
Yeah, I agree.
So, good for you. And then there's all kinds of theme and variations, which are really nice. Red pepper hummus, mushroom hummus, yummy, 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 sun-dried tomato pesto. Lots of really good variations here.
That's probably why hummus is my favorite food, is because it's such a, you can do anything you want with it. I mean, there's no limit.
And you should, because, and as you know, there's lots of good things in sesame seeds that we make tahini from.
Yeah, lots of calcium, decent amount of fiber.
Yeah, vitamin E, I think, is in sesame seeds. Is it vitamin E? Yeah, I don't really think about what's in my food because I know it's all good. But, you know, occasionally I like to highlight things because people seem to think they need to know what's going on nutritionally.
Yeah.
Which is really a silly thing. The idea is that these kinds of diets based on fresh, whole foods, you don't have to know the science. It's easy. Just eat lots of wonderful, colorful foods, and you're going to win.
Yeah, you really don't need to count anything. I mean, I think the great thing about raw food, whole foods in general, but raw food specifically, is that it really fills you up and it tells your body when to stop in a way that I haven't experienced with cooked food. For me, I could, you know, keep eating a bowl of never-ending pasta, but I couldn't eat raw pasta nearly to that degree.
That's the magic of fiber.
Yeah.
And nature did that intentionally.
Right.
So that we don't eat too much. Okay, so for me, somebody who's really involved in food and healthy food, I'm pretty familiar with most of the things you talk about in the book. There's one ingredient, though, I want to talk a little bit about, and that's Irish moss.
Oh, yes.
I actually have a jar of Irish moss in my refrigerator that I probably bought 5 or 6 years ago and have not used very much of, and I'm embarrassed to say this because I always tell people to move the food out of their refrigerators and don't keep stuff for a very long time.
Yeah. Luckily, that seems to last pretty well. I don't know if it'll last years, but...
I know, but I just never really got into it. And so tell me what I can do with Irish moss and why I want to use it.
Well, first of all, I want to tell people that I always use that only as an optional ingredient because I know it's unfamiliar and it can be tough to track down, or depending on where you buy it, you may not want to pay for it, what they're charging. So I don't ever use that as a required part of a recipe. But I have found that it's an amazing addition in many different ways. You can use it for people who are fat sensitive. I don't really like the idea of limiting dietary fats, but I can understand sometimes why people would want to cut out a little of the fat in like a, you know, a cashew cheesecake that's got tons of nuts and coconut oil in it. So you can replace a portion of any type of blended or pureed nuts in a recipe with Irish moss, and it gives the recipe the same amount of body, but it makes it just a little lighter.
Right.
And it does the same things for raw breads, which I actually learned that from Russell James. He was my instructor at the Matthew Kenny Academy, and he makes a killer garlic bread that uses Irish moss blended into it, and it makes the bread really, I mean, fluffy. There's no better word. It's a really fluffy, light, almost spongy quality to it, and that's awesome for raw food because that's hard to achieve.
Right, because so, usually the raw breads are really dense.
Yeah, dense and flat and almost more like, you know, wimpy crackers or something like that.
So I guess it's like a foam maybe when you mix it with water, and then when it gets dehydrated, it keeps that airiness.
Yeah, I think so. When you blend it, it turns into kind of a gel. And then when you add that to a recipe, whether it's a dessert or a smoothie or a bread or something like that, it, especially if you refrigerate it afterward, it thickens even more. And so it gives
more body and more texture to whatever recipe you put in.
Okay, so another ingredient that I don't use very often, well, I don't ever use it, so let's talk about it, and that's all of the raw cacao products, raw cacao powder, cacao nibs, cacao butter.
Mm-hmm.
Does it taste like chocolate?
It does. It tastes more chocolatey than chocolate does in a way sometimes. I mean, raw cacao powder is very strong.
It's great for dark chocolate lovers because it's got the cookies.
Okay, I'm losing you here. I'm not exactly sure why.
Uh-oh.
Oh, you're back. You're back. Very good.
Okay.
You like discipline.
So I was saying raw cacao is great for, like, dark chocolate lovers because it's a very strong chocolate flavor. And the cacao nibs, too, if you're a true chocoholic, then they're great because it's just like chewing on little crunchy bits of chocolate. To me, it's what chocolate should taste like. It shouldn't be over-roasted and combined with, you know, milk powders and fillers and stuff like that. So I like it.
Okay. So I'm not exactly sure how it's made, but it's not roasted.
Right, yeah.
It's a raw form.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think I might have had it in a dessert here and there, but I've never really ventured out and used it.
It's worth looking into.
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to have to try that because it's all about food, and I love variety. Why not?
Exactly.
Okay, so tell me, we just have a few more minutes. What's your favorite in this book? Do you have a favorite?
I have a few favorites. It's hard to pick, but I would say my favorite recipe in the whole book is probably my most popular recipe, period, and that's the famous 5-Minute Blondies in the dessert chapter.
Is that the one you won the award for?
No, it's the caramel fudge brownies are the one that I won the Hot Raw Chef contest with, and that's in the dessert chapter, too.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I would say, is a close second in my favorite desserts, but I love the brownies, blondies, the bar types of desserts. Those are just so low maintenance but easy. I mean, you know, you make cookies, you have to form the cookies. You make a cake or a pie, you have to make the crust and the filling. But with bars or brownies, you just make everything and you press it into a pan and you're done. And I love that.
You know, I'm glad that I'm looking at your book because I used to make a lot of these things and I've kind of gotten out of the habit of it, but these raw cookies, these raw treats, which are just a combination of nuts and dried fruit, are the best desserts you possibly could have. They're good for you, and they're easy, and they're just so delicious.
Yeah, they're good enough for you that I like to tell people that you can eat one for breakfast and not really feel bad about it.
Right. I'm going on a trip, and I'm thinking I should probably make a few of these and take them on the plane with me.
Yeah, good idea.
Really good fuel.
Yes, very.
Okay, well, Amber, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and I wish you great success.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, and let's just get everybody to eat their vegetables, huh?
Agreed.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, well, I really find raw cuisine really fascinating just because it's like somehow we're going backwards, isn't it? People make such a fuss out of eating raw, and it's just, it had to be the way we started eating before we discovered fire. But it's gotten it's gotten a little complicated. But I find that the eating raw can be so much easier. I remember traveling through a while, and I traveled through Europe, and I would tell people I was a vegan or at restaurants be a vegan, and it was a little more challenging than when I was traveling around Europe and saying that I ate only raw food. For somehow it was easier to make a wide variety of interesting raw plates. But I do like my cooked food. But I have to admit that when I went on a 2-year only raw food diet, I did expand my repertoire in raw food preparation. You know, the easiest way to eat is just to grab an apple, grab a banana, maybe grab a bag of lettuce. No preparation at all. But some people might think that would get a little boring, and that's where this gourmet raw cuisine has really evolved. I have to admit that sometimes some of it's a little too rich, where there's a lot of raw nuts and seeds used in the blends, and some raw chefs like to use a lot of nama shoyu, which is supposed to be the raw version of soy sauce, and it gets a little salty and fat. But these recipes in this particular book look really, really very nice overall. It's really fun, and it's an easy way to make really delicious food with such simple ingredients. I really love the whole raw food concept, and you don't need much. I did have a dehydrator for a while, and I don't have it anymore. And you don't really need one. You need a blender or a food processor, and that's really about it. You can make some really incredible sauces just from blending up raw nuts and seeds and some herbs, and I think the whole smoothie scene really got a burst in notoriety from all the raw foodists out there making their different drinks. Some of it's a little nutty. I don't want to use that word too much, but there are some crazy things that people make from raw food, all kinds of crepes and things, and that require a lot of time with dehydration. And personally, I just think it's great to stay with the really fresh foods. And if you want to make a blended salad, a soup or something, like a tomato-based or an avocado-based, cucumber-based creamy soups, those are great. So there you go. Practically raw. Let's take a quick break, okay? And I will be back with Ryan Andrews. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Okay, it's my favorite subject, food, and I love talking about food. And I just found out that I am going to be participating in a number of workshops on May 12th at the Brooklyn Food Conference. Have you heard about the Brooklyn Food Conference? There's going to be over 175 workshops, 350 panelist speakers, and lots of exhibitors. It's a full-day event. And let's see, it's May 12th. Obviously, it's in Brooklyn. And it's at the Brooklyn Technical High School. Starts at 8:30 in the morning, and it goes till 6 p.m. and I'm going to be involved in two workshops. One is at 12:30, and it's called Corporate Power, Diet, and Animal Agriculture. You know I like to talk about those things. And then later on at 2 o'clock, I'll be involved in a workshop on women, feminism, and the use of animals for food. I'm looking forward to that. It's going to be a really interesting time talking about my favorite subject, food. And then, oh gosh, there's so many things going on May. On May 27th in Manhattan, my nonprofit, Responsible Eating and Living, will be exhibiting at the Veggie Pride Parade, and that is a really, really fun event, Veggie Pride Parade. You can go to veggieprideparade.org to find out more about that. Okay, now let's really get to the fun stuff here, and I'm going to bring on Ryan Andrews, who has a new book out called Drop the Fat Act and Live Lean. He is a registered dietitian and strength and conditioning specialist who completed his education in exercise and nutrition at the University of Northern Colorado, Kent State University, and Johns Hopkins Medicine. He's written dozens of research articles on nutrition, exercise, and health, authored Drop the Fat Act and Live Lean, and co-authored The Essentials of Sport and Exercise Nutrition Certification Manual. Ryan is currently a coach with Precision Nutrition, offering life-changing, research-driven nutrition coaching for everyone, and you can find out more about that at precisionnutrition.com. Welcome, Ryan.
Hey, Karen. Thanks for having me.
Oh, sure. I had fun reading your book.
Good. Hopefully you did. I hope anybody who reads my book has a good time.
Yeah, well, there's certainly an attitude in this book about fatitudes.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, the first thing that I like is that you're not afraid to use the word fat.
Yeah, so many people kind of get hesitant to use that word, and I really just mean extra body fat, because mm-hmm. we have a lot of ties to the word fat, whether it's related to somebody's morals or their productivity in life or whatever it might be. But I really just mean, you know, fat is what fat does, and fat means extra body fat.
And we don't need it.
Yeah, it's unnecessary.
Yeah.
We can control it.
I was just reading an article in the New York Times. I think it was a blog post. Tara Parker Pope was talking about how a lot of people see themselves in the mirror and don't really see what they look like, or don't really think of what they look like, and then they see themselves in the mirror, and it's like, whoa, who is that fat person?
Yeah, well, our comparative, the people we compare ourselves to in this country are all fat as well, so it's really tough to get an idea of what's normal. I mean, normal in this country is overweight.
Yeah, that's right. I often hear people saying, oh, that person's so thin, and I think, they're not thin, they're
yeah.
just right. All
right.
of you are just, your scale of things is so off.
Yeah, exactly.
Normal is not good.
Yeah, you're exactly right. Normal is not a good thing right now. We best be abnormal with our eating and our exercise and our habits.
Right. Now, how did you get so smart, Ryan?
I get so smart. Well, fortunately, I have, I think, a pretty good blend of life experience. I've been helping people with eating and exercise since I was about 14 or 15 years old. And then I learned that I could go to college and actually study this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I went there and got a formal education, did grad school, became a dietitian, and I coach people now with eating and exercise. And I think between all my personal experience and formal education, it's a really nice mix, and I can really get an idea of what actually works for people, not just what the textbook says, but what works in real life.
Well, this is a quick book. It's easy to read. There's lots of cute cartoons and humor in it, and it's just a lot of common sense. So I dog-eared a number of pages, like I typically do when I read something. And the first thing I'm looking at is you have some rules, and I'm going to read some of them. Don't eat while reading or watching TV. Don't eat while driving. Sit down at a table to eat. Don't eat dessert before dinner. Eat your vegetables. Go outside and play with friends. Don't stay up all night. And from reading this list, I was thinking of a show I had a few weeks ago where I was talking about a woman who wrote a book called French Kids Eat Better. And in France, in their culture, this is all part of their culture. And it may be changing, unfortunately, because our bad habits are spreading rampantly around the world. But you don't eat while driving in France. You don't eat in the car. The cars don't have those, at least not when I was there in the 90s, didn't have the coffee cup holders.
Yeah.
And you sit down at a table. It's an event where you gather around and you don't eat on the run. You don't eat the snack foods. You sit down and eat properly. And it's part of the culture. And somehow our culture got away from this because I think we did all of these things traditionally at least 50 years ago. So we've really gotten off base. And it's important to see a list like this and say, oops, 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 yep, uh-huh.
Yeah.
How do people react when you give your clients a list like this?
Yeah, it kind of comes back to what we were just talking about with social norms. I mean, this is a lot of people do eat when they drive, and they go to fast food, and they don't go outside and get fresh air and get in the sun and all those things. And it's strange for people to really grasp this, because I think as a kid, maybe they sort of understood it when they were learning about basic health in school. But as they get older, we get into kind of the whole typical adult mindset, and we don't treat our bodies as well. I think one of the best things we can do as adults is kind of treat ourselves like kids, you know, give ourselves some basic foundational guidelines with eating and with exercise and try to follow them. If our kids acted like we acted with our eating and exercise, we'd ground them and send them to their rooms, but we allow ourselves to do it.
I'm just thinking of all the excuses that people must give you when they see some of these rules, like don't eat while driving, like I don't have time, I'm in such a rush in the morning, and I have to eat in the car.
Yeah. the excuses, I try to actually listen to them and not just disregard them and say, oh, no, you're wrong, mm-hmm. You have time. But I always challenge people to think about what they really value in life. What do you really care about? And if you really do care about maybe working downtown and commuting, and so you're spending a lot of time in the car and you're working a lot of hours, well, then maybe you will have to eat in your car. But if you really say, you know what, a number one priority in my life right now is good nutrition, and that means more to me than working a few extra hours at my job, then maybe you could talk to your boss and restructure your day and your schedule and spend 30 minutes at home and eat breakfast before you leave in the morning in your car. So kind of stepping back and looking at the bigger picture and really trying to live according to what you value most.
You have some good quotes in here, and what I like is most of them are quotes I haven't seen before. There's a lot of vegetarian and vegan health books out today, and that's a good thing, but many of them regurgitate the same quotes, and I'm kind of tired of seeing them.
Yeah.
You have one here by George Bernard Shaw. I am oppressed with a dread of living forever. That is the only disadvantage of vegetarianism.
Yeah, my editor, the book publishing company, was great. They helped me find that one, I remember.
And George Bernard Shaw lived to 94, I think.
Mm.
Yeah, he lived a long time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So he knew what he was talking about.
Right.
Huh. Okay, let's see, what else did I bookmark here? Okay, I bookmarked something about mixing it up and the athletes here, but I'm not quite sure why I did it here. Oh, yeah, I like what you write here. Okay, exercise is certainly important, and I really appreciate how you talk about making it fun, not really doing something that you don't like to do, because then you won't do it, obviously.
Yeah.
And the side effects of exercising include, and it's funny when you have to put it this way, side effects include, because we're always hearing about all the drugs on television and all the side effects you get. But the side effects of good eating, the side effects of exercise, more energy, less body fat, more strength, serious flexibility, big biceps, if that's what you're looking for. And it's all good. Those are good things.
Yeah, people forget when we live a certain way, we look a certain way. And so, you know, we're working with laws of nature here, and when we participate in movement and physical activity and we lift weights and move our bodies and stretch our bodies, things happen to our body. And with exercise, fortunately, it's a lot of positive things that a lot of people strive for.
Okay, so you work with a lot of people. What are some of the, I'm going to ask two things here. What things really work with most of them, and what have been your biggest frustrations?
I would say that one of the things that works really, really well is focusing on changing one thing at a time. So instead of trying to do a complete life overhaul and adopting a whole new meal plan and diet and joining a gym and exercising every day, depending on where that person is at, just picking one thing and focusing on that for maybe 2 or 3 weeks and really solidifying it and making it part of your daily life and then moving on to the next habit. That is really, really useful. And another thing that's really useful is getting back to hunger and fullness cues. It's so often forgotten in the world of weight management and body fat and diet books because they say eat this many calories, eat this much protein, carbs, eat at these times, eat these portion sizes. But that's disregarding our own intuition with eating. And when people can really get back to their idea of, I'm hungry, I'm not hungry, I'm satisfied after eating, here's what I'm really craving right now. When people can really be accurate and grasp those concepts, it can do wonders for their nutrition because they don't feel cheated out of foods they're really craving, and they can adjust what they're eating based on what they're actually hungry for.
Right. Okay, so then the next question is, what's been the biggest frustration? The ones that don't get it or have such a really hard time making the changes?
The biggest frustration, I would say for me as a nutrition and exercise coach, is when somebody identifies a priority or a value and they say, you know what, I really do care about my health and I want to make changes to my eating and my exercise, but they don't act on it.
Mm-hmm.
That's really, really frustrating for me because it's one thing if somebody doesn't care about it. They say, oh, yeah, I want to eat better, but they don't really care about it. Oh, that's fine. No big deal. But when somebody really wants to form a new identity and build new habits and they can't quite make it happen, that frustrates me, but it also, I guess, energizes me to keep learning more about how to work with people better and counsel people and get them past that ambivalence because, yeah, that's the ultimate frustration as a coach.
Well, you hit on so many different things. It's not a big book, but you touch on a lot of really important things. And so I think many of us have discovered that problems with weight are related to so many different things. Certainly we've gone down the wrong road when it comes to food, and our whole culture is just so messed up. We don't know anything about food. We don't know how to prepare food. We've totally bought in to believing we need to buy things in a box and eat in restaurants and make it convenient, convenient, convenient when it really isn't convenient.
Yeah.
And we've really been marketed and bought into this whole thing that isn't healthy for us. Okay, so we've lost some sort of intuitive knowledge of how to feed ourselves. But then there's all these other issues. You mentioned addiction to some of the foods that people eat, and then all kinds of emotional issues.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, those are two biggies. You know, a lot of foods, processed foods, have been engineered so we keep eating them. And I don't take it lightly when somebody says to me, Ryan, I can't stop eating junk food X. I believe them. I really believe them when they say that. I don't just kind of blow it off and say, yeah, you know, get some more self-control. Just, you know, tough it out and stop eating. It's tough. I mean, these things are some of these processed foods are really, really powerful. So I think food addiction is massive. I think it's a big issue. And I think people managing their feelings with food, I mean, ties into that a lot. I remember working with a client, and she was eating junk food every day at work and drinking soda every day at work. And she finally realized one day, she said, Ryan, I'm eating junk food and drinking soda every day because I hate my job. It's boring and I'm looking for stimulation. So food was her form of stimulation and enjoyment for the day. So it starts to bring up bigger questions like, how's your career and how's your family life and are you following your passions and volunteering? Because if those areas of life suffer, food might serve as a temporary escape. So, yeah, it's a big issue.
So you're like a shrink.
I think about that more and more. How I wish I would have went to grad school for psychology rather than nutrition because I use nutrition science very little.
Oh, you're right. Okay. Well, Maybe you need to add that. I'm surprised that that's not a bigger profession, that more people aren't into that. The psychology of food, it's just so big.
Yeah, I think it's going to expand. I think it's going to get a lot bigger.
Okay, so now one of the things that you mentioned, that just a lot of things I was going, oh yeah. But the excuses. So one thing is not having the bad food in your home, and yet people will come up with all kinds of reasons why they still have the bad stuff in their home, like their kids need to have it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. I hear that all the time. Ryan, I have to buy junk food X for other family members.
Mm-hmm.
No, you don't. If you don't think it's a good idea to buy a certain food, don't buy it. I find that people who play that family card are really ambivalent about making their own food changes a lot of times, and they're kind of using it as a reason to still kind of get their own fix with that food. But yeah, I think I always tell parents, you know, if you genuinely you don't want to feed yourself this food, don't buy it for other family members. It's a terrible idea. If a food is in your house, you're going to eventually eat it at some point. So, yeah.
I've heard that too with women in particular, older women who feel like they need to make meals for their husbands,
mm-hmm.
and they're trying to get on a healthy path, but they still know that they have to cook for them. And how do you handle that type of situation?
Ooh, yeah. Meal preparation and relationships. It's mm-hmm. tough. It's I try to go step by step with this one and try to find the common foods that the couple or the people in the relationship are eating and really try to go from there. I mean, because if every part of the meal, every component of the meal is different, it can be tough. It might lead to one spouse making a completely new meal. But if you can find some common foods you both enjoy, build from there. You know, have those more often in your regular meal routine, that type of thing. But, yeah, because I'm not a big fan of just saying, you know, cut them off and force them to eat what you like. Everybody changes at their own speed, so.
Yeah, it's tough because, you know, in some ways I think if you're in a relationship and somebody wants to eat healthier to improve their own health, let's say they're in a health crisis and they really need to make a change, the other partner really should be loving and supportive and go along with it. I mean, I'm a big fan of Dr. Furman. I know you showed one of his graphs in your book. And I know when he talks about when children have a health issue, the whole family's got to eat the same way that one child does, all the other siblings. You have to make it, you have to be supportive. And sure, that's the ideal, but it's hard to make it happen.
Yeah. I mean, when somebody's health and life and longevity is coming into play and is affected, definitely I think everybody should be on board. I mean, it makes complete sense to me, but obviously not everybody sees it that way.
I also like at the end of the book how you make your apologies just in case we learn about things in the future that aren't quite right today.
That's so true. Over the years, I haven't even been involved in nutrition as long as a lot of people, but I've seen so many things evolve and change, and I already am apologizing to clients and for articles and things I've written, you know, 10 years ago that are just coming. We're coming to find out that they weren't accurate or they're just not quite how I portrayed them in the beginning. So, yeah, I made my apologies, and I'm sure I'm going to have a lot more in a few more years.
Well, just with doctors as an example, we know doctors used to promote cigarette smoking in the 50s or so. But there are some things that never change and that aren't going to change, and you can be confident in them. And that's this whole concept of whole, fresh fruits and vegetables. Fresh, preferably locally grown, organic, that's not going to change. Those things are what humans have been living on forever, and we know those are healthy foods, whether we know what's in them or not.
Yes, and that is one of the few things. Fruits and vegetables are, it's one of those common themes among all the different dietary groups, so like paleo and vegan and gluten-free and macrobiotic, all the different like nutrition tribes out there. Can agree on vegetables and fruits at least. So that's a nice common theme.
You brought up a good point here, and I'm trying to figure out how to phrase the question. So there are lots of different diet promotions out there.
Yeah.
Some of them clearly aren't healthy. I mean, we know that the low-carb, no-carb, high-protein is a recipe for disaster. But, you know, there are different diets out there that want you to have some animal protein, fish and dairy and eggs and meat, whatever, and there are different ones. Paleo certainly is one of them. And I imagine you have different clients that want to eat certain foods.
Yeah.
The interesting thing is that there really isn't any science today that can prove one diet is superior over another.
Right.
But we do know that plant-based, primarily plant foods, is superior to everything.
Right.
So it's kind of, a lot of people kind of get crazy on the details, and it's really this broad message that we need to get across to everyone.
Yes, indeed. I think there's more similarities than differences. And when somebody says, you know, Ryan, I eat a paleo diet, great.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, paleo isn't paleo to everybody. For somebody, it's 90% animal foods. But for somebody else, it might be 90% plant foods and then 10% of the animal foods. So, yeah, I definitely think there's are more similarities than differences in the healthiest ways of eating.
I don't think you talked about it in here, but how do you eat?
How do I eat?
Yeah.
I think I mentioned it a few times in there, but yeah, I try not to force it down people's throats. But yeah, I eat 100% plant-based diet. I've been eating 100% plant-based for about 6 or 7 years now, and I feel great. Feel better than ever. It's, you know, you don't have to worry about counting calories and protein. You just kind of get in tune with your body cues when you're hungry and when you're satisfied, and choose whole foods and things fall into place, and you get healthy and lean and all that stuff.
Yeah, that's such an important message, and God, how many diets are out there and different programs on television, the doctors and whatever, talk about different diets, and it's crazy, it's wrong, it doesn't work. Eating healthy is easy. You don't need to be a specialist.
Right.
You don't need to count crazy calories, and, you know, you give a good, really good discussion about that, and so I encourage people to, if you're struggling with weight, there's a lot of common sense, good information in here. Definitely, the whole
Thank
calorie
you.
Thing is, I mean, it's just stupid.
Yeah, it doesn't. I mean, it's amazing how a lot of people think, you know, I'm just going to count calories and I'll be set. The best calorie counters are usually the fattest people that I work with. I mean, the heaviest clients I work with know calories better than I know calories. So apparently it's not helping.
No, it isn't. And when you're not satisfied, you're going to eat all the wrong foods. The key is, and I know, you know, you can eat whatever you want, whenever you want, pretty much, if you're eating the right foods.
Yep.
Yeah. Okay, very good. So, precisionnutrition.com, people should go there. What will they find?
Yeah, we have coaching programs. We have a nutrition certification program. I have articles I write. We have a whole bunch of excellent expert authors and professionals on there to get help and who write articles. So it's a really great website.
And you recommend people using a coach if they're struggling with weight loss?
I do. I think it's a good idea to use a coach.
Okay, well, there you have it. Ryan, thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, and thank you for helping people drop the fat, act, and live lean.
Thank you, Karen.
Okay, be well. I'm Karen Hartglass. You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thank you for joining me, and please visit responsibleeatingandliving.com, my nonprofit website. Have a very, very, very delicious week. Bye-bye.